Do you see Malta as being an ideal place for crypto asset service providers? Do we have an edge over other jurisdictions?
I think we do.
Let's face it, Mika is putting crypto asset service providers on the same level of financial institutions.
They should be. Why they shouldn't?
Yes, sure, but
they deal with the same thing. It's financial services. Just because it's crypto doesn't make it any different.
Welcome to another episode of Block 101. Today we have with us Tanya Dimitrievich. Tanya is a lawyer based in Malta. She's been in Malta for quite a while. She used to work with me as well. Tanya is a lawyer that worked in various sectors in Malta, particularly both fintech and gaming, which are two very thriving industries here. Tanya is also from Serbia, but she lived, as I said, in Malta for quite some time, for over 15 years. So, Tanya, welcome.
Thank you, Joe.
So you have been here for the past 15 years plus.
Yes.
Why do foreigners find Malta a good place to settle? What has kept you personally here?
I can only speak from the personal experience. As you said, I moved here 21 years ago. I moved here with my parents. Went to secondary school, then moved back to Serbia while I was in high school, university, and 9 years ago I just came for a little bit since my sister was living here, and well, it's been 9 years ever since. Why do we come here? I think it's the lifestyle and everything else that Malta has to offer. It's such a vibrant place, you know, you have so many different industries, as you were mentioning, fintech and iGaming, so it gives you a good opportunity for professional growth. But then on the other hand, it's like you can have a coffee in January outside next to the sea. You can't do that in many places in Europe. And
having a good job as well.
And having a good job, exactly.
You can have it, but you can have it in a remote area maybe, which is just touristic, so in winter it's
exactly,
there.
And you're not really connected as you are when you're living in Malta, you know. It's just a couple of hours flight away from anywhere in EU. And you do experience that corporate lifestyle because of your good jobs and the positions that you can have here. But then the moment you leave your job, you can be the hippie on the beach. You know, you can just walk without your shoes and you can have the summer parties everywhere. That's like a really good thing about Malta. You have that very good balance.
And everything is very close by.
So everything is very close by.
You're next to
the beach. Let's not lie to people. We have problems with traffic here as well. So even though on a map it looks near, it's just simply not.
So Tanya, now you are head of legal of Red Acre Group,
yeah,
which is a group which has a number of ventures in fintech.
That's true.
You have also worked in the gaming industry, both in the advisory and also in-house. And you have also worked both in gaming and fintech, in external advisory as well as in-house. You always tell me that you prefer working in-house.
Yes.
But tell me more about your experiences as working in-house and external in both industries.
Yeah, as you said, like it's a very diverse background. I started as a legal trainee in a corporate service provider. It was a corporate administration and basic commercial contract. So that's where I started. Then I transitioned into WH, where I mentored you for around 3 years, I think. And it was in the blockchain, crypto, and iGaming. So the main focus was regulatory compliance. I mean, that's what we were doing. And what law firms and even corporate service providers offer you is you're exposed to many different clients, and they all have different projects, they have their own demands, but essentially what happens is that you're specialized only in one area, be it GDPR, be it marketing, commercial contracts, regulatory compliance, and there's a lot of potential for growth there, but again, you're just specializing in one area. And people usually think that working in-house is not as challenging. And I would say that probably in certain companies it's not, but again, it depends where you are and it depends on the type of person you are. So when you are an advisor, you're there, your clients approach you, you give them the advice and you move on. When you're in-house, you need to understand how the business works.
You do have to understand how the business works to give proper advice externally.
Yes, but what's happening in-house is you need to understand how your organization works and what advice is the best for your organization as well. And that means you also have to be a psychologist because you need to understand different departments and you need to learn how to speak different languages as well. You can't speak the same language with developers, definitely not. You can't speak the same language with people who are in marketing. Legal and compliance, obviously no one likes you, so you really need to learn how to speak to people without sounding human as well. This is our joke internal that we have. And then, you know, it's not just one area that you need to specialize. Even though we deal with regulatory compliance, you also need to understand the legal aspects of everything. And that's why I would say it's a more challenging and a dynamic environment than it is when you're working in an advisory. And then, as you said, I worked in iGaming and I worked in blockchain or fintech. So when we started in 2018, you had that amazing buzz around crypto and blockchain, and you felt as if you're working in something. It was a revolutionary force that is going to change everything. It's going to change the world. So your ego is growing over there, and you feel that there is a purpose in what you're doing. Unfortunately, when I was making the move from advisory to in-house, there were not so many opportunities in fintech and blockchain in particular. So I moved into iGaming. And I have to say, and I'm going to admit this now, my ego was huge, obviously, you know, and coming from WH Partners and after 3 years of working with regulators, with MFSA, with
me, obviously.
With you. like my ego was huge. I knew everything, right? So I was going to go into iGaming industry and I'm going to show them how things are going to be done. And 3 weeks in, the general counsel looked at me and he was like, "How do you feel?" And I was about to cry. I wanted to cry every day. And I was like, I'm okay. He's like, "You're not overwhelmed." I'm like, "I'm really overwhelmed." He's like, "Okay, now you can actually understand what you're getting yourself into." And that's it, you know, like you think you know, but you don't until you go in-house. And I loved it. But what I missed in iGaming was that purpose that I was talking about. Like the iGaming industry has been there for quite a long time. And I felt that I was just missing something. So the moment that the opportunity in fintech presented itself, I just went for it. And now I work in an environment, as you were saying, we're a big group. We work in fintech. We work in we're technology providers. We're working in crypto. There's so many different areas, and it's just never a dull moment.
Okay, very interesting. So the challenge is what makes the main difference, of course, for you when it comes to the industry. And with respect to in-house and outside counsel, I would say that yes, you have one of. So I worked in-house as well in two situations. One as in a private company at Vodafone. Which at the time was like the cool place to work at, like gaming was over the past 15 years. And then I was at the regulator, which is a completely different situation, of course. It's a completely different gameplay. But something that I definitely noticed is that when you're in-house, you see the project from start to finish. When you're external, you see the project up to a certain degree, but then at the end, you're not involved till the end of the whole project. So that is one thing that makes in-house more interesting, I would say. On the other hand, when a company consolidates and you keep on doing the same things, you're not doing something new, it can get boring, while when you're external, you're obviously seeing a new project every day from different companies. So that keeps the excitement going. So I'll have to have another podcast with you in 3-4 years' time once your company consolidates and doesn't invent new business
that's
areas.
That's never going to happen. No. That's not the group I'm in. I'm sorry. No.
And then we'll see if you're still so challenging, if you're still seeing it so challenging.
But that's another challenge, Joe, because just because you have a product that's working well doesn't mean that the product is going to work well in a couple of years.
Definitely.
So what you need to have within your in-house environment is obviously teams that are going to build that project, that you have to constantly invent and innovate. So no, like the company that you described is not really a good company. And in 3 to 5 years, I won't be in the same environment. So no.
Good luck to you. Good luck. We'll see. No, joking apart, of course, there are two different realities and both of them have their pros and cons. And it also depends on the person, who the needs of that person, the situation of that person. So there are both good situations to be in, I would say.
I agree.
Better than not having a job, definitely.
Definitely.
Let's talk more about fintech now, about our beloved MiCA. So the markets in crypto assets regulation, which came out finally earlier this year. It will come into force. It is in force. It will become applicable.
Yeah.
Part of it mid next year and part of it at the end of next year. We are more interested in the one that will become applicable at the end of next year, which is the part relating to crypto asset service providers, because you as a group have crypto asset service providers as part of the group, which unfortunately are not based in Malta, as far as I know.
No.
But that is one question I want to ask you. Do you see Malta as being an ideal place for crypto asset service providers? Do we have an edge over other jurisdictions?
I think we do. And now I really need to praise MFSA. And I have to say that, we started 5 years ago, right? And we had the VFA Act. And us as advisors, we were somewhere in the middle between MFSA and the service providers, which were looking to obtain a license in Malta. And if you remember, initially we were so happy with the framework, and it was such a robust framework, and we loved it, and it mirrored MiFID, which is exactly what MiCA is doing now, right? So they're almost equivalent legislation. I think MiCA is even a bit lighter in certain aspects.
It is.
But the industry was not prepared for it at all. And I remember after a couple of months and even a year in, our enthusiasm was going down because the industry was constantly telling us that the framework was wrong. MFSA was standing their ground, and that proved to be a very good thing this 5 years later. And I think we were getting these punches from both sides for a very long time. And I remember me being tired, and that's why I actually kind of moved out, because I didn't see any results. And now 5 years after, we have MiCA, which after a lot of negotiations on the EU level, like it at least it's not perfect, but it's best what we have, not only obviously in Europe, but in the world as well. If you look at what Gary is doing in US, it proves that US is not a place where you're going to innovate. So
yeah, we'll come to that. We'll come to that in more
we'll
detail
get that.
As well.
Exactly. So now Malta is a very good place. Why? Because it's been 5 years. MFSA, they know what they're doing, because they had 5 years of experience, something that the regulators within EU didn't. They're lawyers, they're accountants. So because obtaining
there's a whole ecosystem.
There's
now
a whole ecosystem, you know. It's not just about applying for a license with the MFSA. You need the right advisors, you need auditors, you need tech people, you need developers. Not everyone, but at least in Europe, there is a lot of people who are based in Malta. And again, we have a good ecosystem because 5 years ago, because of all the blockchain islands, a lot of companies moved here, and people, whether they're doing business or not, they remained here. So that's something which is really positive about Malta. And then obviously, if you start applying for a license in Malta now, you can position yourself ahead of everyone else because you'll get a VFA license, you'll go through the simplified authorization process with the MFSA, and obviously, I don't know, it might take days or weeks.
That is very interesting. So this is the simplified process. The simplified authorization process is probably the biggest advantage of being in Malta, right? I spoke with this about this with Camille in a previous podcast, and Camille from the Malta Financial Service Authority. And if you haven't watched that podcast,
I did. It was brilliant. Yeah,
recommend to everyone to watch it because so many insights came out of that podcast. I believe that we are in a situation where operators will be the first ones, operators that are based already in Malta or that will manage to obtain a Malta license by the end of next year. So they have to rush. They will be in a situation where they will be the first ones to have a MiCA license.
Which means you can passport that straight away across the EU.
Exactly.
And that's a really good benefit, right?
And it is great also because we know that many jurisdictions, let's take Germany, is creating a lot of problems for operators licensed elsewhere and not having a BaFin authorization right now to actually offer their services in Germany. Once they can passport...
Exactly. I mean, you can operate wherever you want within the EU, at least within the EU member states. And then... there's another very good thing in Malta is that the MGA sandbox, right, which allows gaming companies to accept crypto within their business if they have a Maltese VFA service provider. And so if you have a license in Malta and you have the whole iGaming ecosystem, that's another benefit for you.
That's already a very good basis to start off your business if you are not so big yet as well. Definitely. Well, now the MGA transitioned into from the sandbox actually to policy.
Exactly.
So it's even more comprehensive and it's cast in stone now. It's no longer something temporary. So it's very interesting, of course. So speaking of Europe, do you think that Europe has placed itself as a leader in globally when it comes to regulation of crypto, or maybe we have gone too far, just like Malta probably had gone a bit too far 5 years ago?
5 years ago, I would say we've gone too far. Now, I wouldn't. But like, did Europe position itself as a leader? It's very hard to say that. I can't say that with certainty. But do we provide a very good framework which gives you the legal certainty, which is something that's really needed at this stage? So for years we've been fighting is a big word, but with crypto industry who was against regulations, right? And then we had the Terra Luna crash, then we had the FTX, and I think everyone now understands the importance of regulations. And when I speak about regulation, I'm speaking about the centralized service provider, so regulate them. Provides for a robust framework that's going to allow for the investor protection, market integrity, fair competition, everything that we need. So without that, I think that's what the big players are waiting for as well, right? Because why invest time and money and resources and everything into something where you don't even know what's going to happen a couple of months or years down the line? You don't know within which framework you're going to operate. So MiCA is a very good thing for Europe.
I am a former regulator and I have worked most of my life in regulation, so I don't hate regulation, definitely. But I do hate, and I use the word specifically hate, I don't usually hate anything, but I really hate over-regulation.
Okay.
Why? Because I am a very, let's say, democratic or possibly even capitalist person in the sense that I want everyone to have the opportunity to thrive.
Okay.
Like, and I feel that overregulation stifles the possibility for startups to compete with the giants.
Okay. All right?
Because big companies, and this is my philosophy, maybe it's wrong, but this is my philosophy. Big companies can always comply with whatever you throw at them. because they will just employ more people that will have them help them to become compliant. They will invest in technology and it will help them comply. Startups, for them to employ more people, for them to invest in more technology, is much, much, much tougher. So I'm always very, very skeptical about what sounds like overregulation. So that is my philosophy. That is how I am. I prefer having less regulation by giving the opportunity to everyone rather than having more regulation that kills the startups or the smaller players in the industry. And I know that this is maybe not a popular opinion in our industry because many people have thrived through mergers and acquisitions. But at the same time, I'd rather have a small company become big and compete with the bigger ones than having four or five big companies buying out all the smaller ones. I don't like that personally, even though many people do well with that, including lawyers. But in my that is not within what I would like to see. Maybe I'm a dreamer, but I have that American dream in mind that having someone start from nothing and becoming big. But my question is this. Is MiCA overregulation or not?
I wouldn't say. And this is my personal view, because MiCA regulates crypto assets and service providers, right? These are financial services. So we had a case of under regulation, and then we had the financial crisis. And all the regulation that we have now is just a result of lack of effective regulation that we had before. Is MiCA perfect? It's not. Do we have a perfect regulation? We'll never have a perfect regulation. Are there certain clauses within MiCA that might be a bit too much? Probably yes. But at the end of the day, we are operating in a financial services sector. We are talking about people's investments and their lives and everything. Yes, you know what? I do agree with you. We do need to have a good environment for startups. But even those startups, they need to invest in compliance and they need to invest in people definitely, who are going to help them understand this. So I really can't answer this because it's for me personally, it's very difficult to answer this question. I do believe that we need to have a good regulation, and I wouldn't agree that less regulation is better sometimes, because as long as we are operating within the financial services sector, because essentially financial services sector is for people to make money.
Or to lose all their money.
Or lose all the money. So you know what? I want to regulate people who can affect people losing a lot of money. So no, the moment they start receiving more profit, the more greedy they become. So no, you put a stop to that. Sorry. In any other industry, yes, fair enough, let's not overkill with regulation. And I know what you're saying, like that's a bad side of overregulation. You push everyone in the black markets, right? But in this particular case, no.
I'm not so sure, because in the end, although there was a lot of talk about it, MiCA is not basically, does not go beyond our territory, and it sort of allows reverse solicitation. So,
yeah, well, yes, exactly.
So, in my opinion, that ruins everything. So if you want to have a proper framework, you cannot allow reverse solicitation in this field.
How can you stop reverse solicitation?
Well, for example, they created extraterritorial powers for GDPR. So technically, from wherever you are, if you're taking data from Europeans, from European citizens, then you have to comply with GDPR. I know it's not working, and that's the next point. How are you going to enforce it?
But then again, like this is what we're talking about, personal data, and here we're talking about financial system. Imagine same MiCA thing. Being extraterritorial. Imagine US or everyone else reacting to that. You can't.
No, but if you want to put a high standard, all right, for operators that want to take business in Europe, but then you allow operators coming from outside of Europe to compete with these operators that have this high threshold, I don't find
but
that.
You're not really allowing them, because then if we look into the regulation, you can't directly target or market. It's like the reverse solicitation works on the fact that, yes, I approach this provider because I've heard of him. And like, it's not as if I'm going to go out.
We all know
and,
how it works in financial
all,
services.
Exactly. But I don't think that you cannot, that you can do this in the financial services. You can't have the extraterritorial system and not have reverse solicitation.
I believe creating an unlevel playing field, as they have done in financial services, is a big challenge for operators based in Europe. But that is my view. I would have tried to work more towards finding a proper way to protect operators that are agreeable and agree and comply with this high level of regulation that we have created. And there, maybe there, you'll have a situation where even startups can start competing, at least in that particular small market, which is the EU. Because let's face it, we think that Europe is the center of the world. It is not. It is no longer the center of the world. It is a very important block, but it is not the center of the world. And there are other areas in the world that are growing more.
I think there is a way to actually protect service providers, because what can essentially happen is that even though you allow reverse solicitation, if you look what the regulators within EU are doing, is that they're constantly issuing notifications and notices on their website stating this
do not use this, do not use
do
that.
Not
is it effective
this.
In your opinion?
When let's say that an operator ABC wants to then apply for a license within EU in any jurisdiction. Do you think that's a reputational risk for them? Do you think that some regulators might not look at that in a good way and that might eventually prevent them from obtaining a license? That's just one of the ways how you can protect them.
Fair enough, good point. In fact, we're seeing, for example, Binance pulling out of some markets in Europe.
Exactly.
So, yeah, could be. I still believe that they should have done more from that point of view. But yes.
They also know more than us, so they probably know the reason why they cannot do that.
Yeah, fair enough. Maybe it's also political at this stage.
I really believe that's
so
a political
rather
thing.
Rather than legal. But
yeah.
Again, Binance is Binance. Smaller operators will not have the same problems that Binance has and can actually compete unfairly, let's call it that way, with operators that are trying to comply with this very, very high, because let's face it, Mika is putting crypto asset service providers on the same level of financial institutions.
They should be. Why they shouldn't?
Yes, sure, but
there's no but. They deal with the same thing. It's financial services. Just because it's crypto doesn't make it any different.
No,
the risks are the same for the retail clients, for the investors. The risks are the same.
Yes,
so put them
enough.
in the same basket.
Also keeping in mind that financial institutions in Europe are heavily regulated, also compared to financial institutions in other areas of the world as well. More.
Where
regulated.
Do you feel safer?
Well, we've had our problems, like we've seen Wirecard go bust when everyone had that sense of security about Wirecard. I would have put all my money in Wirecard without betting an eyelid.
In general, would you put your money in a jurisdiction that is heavily regulated and where the regulations are enforced as well? Or would you go to a jurisdiction where that's not the case? Where would you put your money?
Well, to be fair, after Wirecard's blunder,
it's
one, but it's a big one.
Okay.
We've seen also banks going bust in Switzerland.
Okay.
We've seen banks going bust in the US,
we've
one after the other.
We've seen them going bust everywhere. That was not my question. Where would you put your money? Somewhere where we have a good regulation?
You know what? I would disperse my money as much as possible in order to safeguard it as much as possible, because
yes,
if one goes bust, at least part
but
of my
not
money is still
answering my
somewhere
question
else.
Again, where would you feel safer with your money?
I would mix. I believe that a mix is the ideal situation, even in terms of geographical situations, because what we've learned out of the Ukraine war is that nowhere is really safe. Like, Ukraine is very close to us, and the unthinkable happened in Ukraine. So I believe there were many people investing money in Ukraine over the past years before the war, because everyone was saying, I remember, especially in the gaming industry, there was a whole buzz around the Ukraine. There were a number of operators opening there and a number of operators moving there some stuff because they have great developers. Suddenly, whoever invested in Ukraine lost everything. So what happened in Ukraine can happen everywhere.
That's true.
And that's why I believe that the only way to protect yourself is either by putting your eggs in different baskets, as we always say.
Yeah.
Or else put them on your offline wallet. Speaking of crypto.
And okay.
Because unless you lose that wallet, then obviously that money is always with you, right?
Yeah, but then in which assets do you put them? In stable coins or not?
Again, mix them up.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, okay, after this lesson in safeguarding your assets, which is not financial advice. So you mentioned stable coins, and now we have a new form of stable coin, which is coming, which is CBDCs, Central Bank Digital Currencies, which is... to say it is something that is creating a lot of discussions is an understatement, I would say.
Yeah.
And I believe that anything that comes from institutions in crypto is a good thing. Why? Because it will bring crypto more and more to the mainstream.
Okay.
So if the government enters the crypto space,
okay,
then people that today are skeptical about crypto, or they refuse to adopt crypto, or refuse to accept this industry as legit, will up to a certain extent have to get involved in crypto. Not the proper crypto, but the one created by governments, but this might push them towards in the future also using proper crypto. So that is my view, maybe the only positive of CBDCs. But definitely there are a ton of issues with CBDCs. Tell me all about
them. What
are
the issues? it's funny how you mentioned that they will be pushed to use proper crypto. I'll come back to that. I don't think we're having enough discussions about CBDCs. Because I think the discussions that we are having are about should we have them or should we not, at least from my experience, when in fact, like, CBDCs are here. China already has its digital yen. And we have over 100 jurisdictions which are either in the development stages or in the research stages for CBDCs. We need them. Definitely, because the current traditional financial system, it's slow, it's siloed, it's just not functioning. It's ridiculously expensive. So the CBDCs will find its use in international transactions and also on the individual levels. Now, why are we scared about CBDCs? Is because the risk of sounding like a character from 1984. I mean, this is the biggest threat to our economic freedom and to our financial privacy that we've ever seen before. We didn't have this until now. And I don't think we're talking about it enough. So if you can just picture the world in which you can, because CBDCs can also be a programmable money, you know, and you can have a portion of your money allocated, I don't know, these are your, this portion of your money you can use for your expenses, for your food, for this, for that. And you can be cut out of the financial system within a second with central bank digital currencies. And obviously I'm talking about the worst case scenarios. And we are already in an era in which we are deliberately giving up on our privacy through social medias and selling of data and all of that. And now we're going to give up on our financial freedom just due to convenience. It's pure convenience. This is what we're looking into. So, and then what worries me even more is that in parallel, we are having these discussions around CBDCs are bad and stable coins are good. I don't think we should be having this and proper crypto, because essentially with Mika, we are saying that the stable coins will be regulated. Right? So the issuers of stable coins, the private sector.
Well, to be honest, they're going to be regulated in a way that benefits CBDCs.
Exactly,
well.
Exactly. So, but the whole point is that you will not have a system in which stable coins will not be regulated. Like, I stand to be corrected, but I think we'll have stable coins because they're the direct competitors
to the governments.
So we'll have to regulate them. And then if we continue this talk about CBDCs are bad, let's all go to stable coins. Guys, these guys will be regulated. They will sell us out in order to get a license, exactly. In order to be compliant. So there is no discussions about this is good and this is bad. Proper crypto is good and proper crypto is bad. Essentially, proper crypto will be Bitcoin and maybe a few others, but that's the only thing. And will it push people towards crypto? But again, crypto is not easy to use, right? It's really not. So we have to make it very convenient. So people will not care what is the technology behind it. They will not go into understanding, because no one actually understands how our traditional financial system works.
But it may push developers of cryptocurrencies.
To help stablecoin issuers?
Forget stablecoins. I'm talking of proper crypto now.
Proper crypto?
So proper crypto, I would say, is anything between Bitcoin and Ethereum and maybe four or five other coins.
Okay.
So for me, that is proper crypto. No, like the crypto that has its own chain that basically was made in a way that is as decentralized as possible. Maybe yes, some of them are a bit more, some of them are a bit less, but still give you the confidence.
So decentralized, that's what
we're getting. I believe, yes, decentralization is the whole point of crypto. Which we don't have with CBDCs. And that's why. I am not someone who is a conspiracy theorist or someone who is all the time against the system, but I do challenge the system.
Okay.
And I believe that lawyers have a duty to challenge the system.
Agreed.
Just like students at university should be the first people to go out to protest.
Yes.
All right. That happens everywhere. It always happened, unfortunately, in Malta, not really, but...
Serbians can teach you that.
You Serbians can teach us that. And we've seen it in many other jurisdictions, many other countries, where students are the first people to protest, because the student, the young person, should be the first person to challenge the system. And as much as students should challenge the system, it's lawyers who should challenge the system. It is our duty. Unfortunately, now we are developing this new practice, which is lawyers that are always favoring and justifying the system because it pays to be always in line with the system. But I'm also realizing that now the people that are challenging the system in some way or another are not just the conspiracy theorists. In the past, it was like the conspiracy theorists are always creating some conspiracy theory that the government is doing this, and which was extreme. I don't agree with conspiracy theorists. But I think now it's a time in the history of humanity where people are saying, look, they weren't always wrong, the conspiracy. And there were a few situations where they were right, and we should think of whether what we are being fed is 100% correct. We all know that media is quite biased.
That's true.
Depending on where you are. So... and definitely you can't compare how biased media is in a democratic society compared to a society where there's a dictator. So let's be clear. But I'm seeing people challenging the system without being too extreme.
Okay.
And I think that's very positive. And I believe that initially CBDCs will be accepted by everyone because they're coming from the government, except those that are actually always against whatever the government comes up with. And people like us who understand the challenges of the CBDCs. But eventually, those people that will adopt CBDCs will start seeing this as well, like they're seeing it with media today. And they will start saying, isn't crypto better because it's completely decentralized and it's completely anonymous? Why should the government know that I gave you, for example, a donation of 2,000 euros? I didn't give you a donation.
If your entire wealth, but if you're getting your salaries or you're getting any sort of funds through the central bank digital currencies, we are looking into a risks where you are being controlled as to where do you transfer it out. So will you be allowed in the worst case scenario to use those funds to buy proper crypto, as you call it? So we are seeing these risks. I'm going to go for the worst case scenario in everything, which is why I think now is the time for all of us to start having the discussions, to be actively involved in the policy making around these crypto, both for the private and the public sector as well. So we need to make sure that the privacy concerns are tackled in these regulations.
They can't be tackled, but because
you just said that lawyers need to be the first one to fight, and if you're telling me they can't be, they can be. We just need to have proper discussions around it.
Okay, but my point is the fact that this currency is going to be controlled by a government institution, whichever that is now, whether it's a central bank, whether it's, I believe that a degree of freedom is going to be lost for sure.
A degree is fine.
So how big the degree, you mean?
Exactly. Oh, okay. A degree one, yes. I mean, we are giving up our freedom now in general. Like our money is in banks. We are doing all the transactions online. Everything is traceable. Everything is auditable. So yes, like even with crypto, even though it's anonymous, you can still trace the transactions. And with the right tools, we're really going to develop good tools to actually identify everything. You can't hide anything in crypto and in blockchain. So let's put that out there too.
Be clear, just for people who might be watching this podcast, we're not saying, look, we want to protect criminals so that they can do the transactions they want.
Exactly.
We just want to have the possibility that if I want, for example, to fund a political party, all right, because I believe in their cause, no one should be able to see that I am supporting that political, because ultimately that is a fundamental
right,
and also it is sensitive. If you look at the GDPR, it's sensitive personal data. If I have some disease and I'm trying to cure it, I don't want everyone to know that I have that disease, for example. These are two situations where you have very sensitive personal data that ultimately the government is going to get to know about.
But even without that, look, I go to work from Monday to Friday. I work, I get my money. I want to spend it in the way I want to spend it.
Exactly.
I don't want anyone to go through my transactions and go and create a profile based on what I'm doing. We are all already doing that with social media,
yes.
You know, so you can literally profile me in a second. I don't want...
But I can control social media. I can choose what I
yes.
put on it.
Yes, in this particular case, we cannot. So they are a very, 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 very big threat. And I can't say this enough. It's not just about CBDCs. It's in general, even the private sector issued cryptocurrencies. So now let's focus on that as well. Let's focus on the values that we are going to embed in the regulation around these things. So are we going to have democratic values? Are we going to protect our privacy? Are we going to have anti-censorship in there? This is all that we need to do. And we need to just stop talking about whether I like or I dislike CBDCs. They're there, and whether I like central stable coins or not. we do not have a very good education system, and we need to learn from the past mistakes. So the best way to, and this is a conspiracy theory in me, and I grew up in Serbia. I grew up in Serbia. I've seen a lot of, we went through inflation, hyperinflation, we went through international sanctions. I've seen what power money has. And the best way to control people is actually through their finances. So we are not educating people enough about financial system, because if we did, I think we would have demonstration many more than we have now. So what we need to do now is start educating kids about finances and financials, the traditional financial system and crypto as well. We are not doing that enough. If we start doing that enough, we'll have the discussions about all of these topics that we had. But people are just simply not involved because it's just too much. It's overwhelming when you start.
I agree. And one of the responsibilities of the industry is proper education.
And yes, so now even the industry, like, and I always said that, and we are both involved in the crypto industry here in Malta. Let's not go in war against regulators anymore. Let's not go in war against lawyers or whoever. Let's just find a common ground and let's just start educating everyone. We're not going to have a good regulation unless we start having good discussions around regulations. We're not going to fix problems unless we start identifying what the problems are and start having an open and transparent conversation. We don't have that because everyone attacks everyone. And every time you point out that something is wrong, someone feels attacked. It's not. You're just like calling for a discussion, you know? So these are the things that we really need to start doing.
I agree perfectly. Wow, we disagreed for most of the podcast, but on the last few topics, we agreed on everything.
That's typical of us, exactly.
So one last comment from you. Why should people come to Sigma and the IBC in November?
It's fun. Besides that, Sigma in Malta is one of the biggest events, let's face it. I've been to Sigma around the world as well. The quality is good, but Sigma Malta has an established presence here. There's a lot of different industry players, and there is a really good opportunity to meet very interesting people and to help your business if needs be.
Tanya Dmitrievich, thank you for your time.
Thank you,
Joe. Thank you, everyone, for following us, and until next time.